Welcome to After the Deluge. I am Justin Cox. Reinventing Axl Rose is Against Me's debut full-length record. It was released on March 5th, 2002 on No Idea Records and produced by Rob McGregor. Reinventing Axl Rose, to me, is the starkest contrast between the catchy pop side of things and the unpolished ferocity of this band. That contrast is a defining characteristic of Against Me, in my opinion, and it's all over this record. It's also the moment that Against Me becomes a band. Alongside Laura Jane Grace, we have James Bowman on guitar and backing vocals, Dustin Friedkin on bass, and Warren Oakes on drums. You can almost feel them going from, like, acoustic busking friends to a proper band in real time on these recordings. I love this quote from Oakes, who was working out how to incorporate drums on these songs, many of which had already been recorded. In a 2002 spin piece by John Chesler, Oakes asks the band, "What if we did this weird little skippy turnaround off-time thing right here, and they just stop dead, like, no fucking math. Just don't even go down that path at all." So I would play it straight and just try to incorporate these little things, which is exactly what he does on those records. My guest and I talk quite a bit about the drums on this record, specifically the sound of them. I invoke Star Wars, they invoke Metallica. It's fun. By the time I was ready for Against Me in college, I was naively in the thick of whatever post-9/11 version of right versus left was happening on, like, cable news and stuff. Something like Baby, I'm an Anarchist and even like Michael Moore documentaries were kind of paradigm shifting and radical for me. I wasn't among the type of people in high school and everything that were like passing that kind of thing down. And when I found them, I welcomed them. I mean, it was like I explored that stuff. You watched in awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning that fucker and shaking my black flag. In the last episode with Frank Turner, I noted the 59-word paragraph that serves as the chorus for Walking is Still Honest, which also appears on this record alongside several other previously recorded Against Me tracks. The titular track on this record has a chorus that contains only one word. That word is woe. I'll play a bit of that song in just a second. And after that, we're going to go to my interview with Austin Lucas, an acclaimed songwriter and musician whose roots are in hardcore, but has forged a musical career expanding on the traditions of American roots music. That career crosses paths with Against Me several times, beginning in the early 2000s, and most recently with their latest record, Reinventing Against Me, which was born out of an early pandemic tweet exchange with Laura Jane Grace. It is a collection of Against Me songs, all recorded and interpreted in Austin Lucas's signature country style. And you'll hear more about how that came to be in this conversation. If you have some friends who might enjoy a podcast that goes album by album through the Against Me discography, you should tell them about this one. I put each episode into the world and just sort of hope that it finds the right people, so I appreciate you helping make that happen. Here is the song Reinventing Axl Rose, followed by my conversation with Austin Lucas.
My first exposure to Against Me was like through the grapevine. I'm from Bloomington, Indiana, which is where Planet X Records used to be from, which was a seminal folk punk record label run by kind of a fucking total piece of shit. So I was in one of the very first bands on that record label, like back in the 90s when they were just releasing cassettes. I was in a band called The Dirties. And I think we were the second or third cassette that Planet X Records like ever released. Like well before anybody had any idea what was going on there and before it became really any kind of a thing. So I was like adjacent to this like rising scene or whatever. I was really in the crust scene. I was in like, you know, I was more into like metallic crust and peace punk, anarcho hardcore stuff. You know what I mean? Like, but I was surrounded by like kind of some of the important folk punks of like the late 90s and early 2000s. And I moved to San Francisco around the same time that David Dondero and his then partner, Terry, who was in This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb, moved to San Francisco. This is in 2001. And I had played with Dave in 2000. I don't know how do I put this? I've been doing my project since 99, 2000.
Yeah.
And of course it sounded different, but like 2000 is when I started playing shows, and I played a show with Dave Dondero before I ever moved to San Francisco, and that's how I met him, through like, mutual friends and stuff. And then the band Against Me was kind of like on everybody's lips, but I hadn't listened to them. And my best friend, like one of my very, very best friends, I should say, from high school, was like, "Hey, you like Crust? I bet you would really like this band Against Me." And I was like, "Oh, cool. Like, you like a Crust band?" Because my friend Amy was not into Crust punk at all. She was into punk, but not into Crust punk. So I was excited. And she's like, "Let me send you the CD." So she sent it to me when I was living in San Francisco. And I got it and I put it on. And I was like, "This is not fucking Crust." I was like, "I don't know what this garbage is, but it's not fucking Crust." Now,
To someone like your friend or someone like me, that's like, oh, hell yeah, I'm into crust punk now because it's as close as someone who just wants to sing along to catchy melodies is.
I understand that Against Me is most assuredly Crust adjacent. You know what I mean? Like, and there's no question that like, there were people who were super into Crust punk in the band Against Me. You know what I mean? Like, and people who liked Crust punk liked Against Me also. But my first introduction to them was Crime as Forgiven by Against Me when it came out. And which, side note, I almost called this record Against Me as Forgiven by Austin Lucas, but it was a long title and I wanted to sh shorten it down. But it was literally, it was on the art, actually, the first art before it went to pressing. It said Against Me as Forgiven by Austin Lucas.
Dang.
But anyway, that's another thing. So I didn't like it when I first heard it, not because it wasn't good, but because like it wasn't what I expected. And I think that that's like one of the things that human beings suffer from, is that like the reality of something and our expectations of it.
Oh, God, yeah.
So like at first I was like, no. Then like they came and played Bloomington. I moved back to Bloomington at the end of 2001. And they came and played Bloomington, and I went and saw them, and they were just like undeniable. You know what I mean? It's like when you see a band that's just like that full on, you know what I mean? And fun
There's
and
probably also this thing that's like, as much as that felt more accessible than your average crust punk band when your friend sent the record over, seeing that live, it gets a it, there's a there's another like n couple notches up in energy and looseness and everything about it.
it was also put forth to me that they were like, "Yeah, like they're not a crust band, they're a peace punk band." And I was like, "Yeah." And then I was like, "I like that. I like them."
It needed to be framed correctly to like.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like once I put it into like the, I don't know, into the framework of like Crass Records, you know what I mean? I all of a sudden was like, "Yeah, totally. This is really, really good."
We're all presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops, and winning with the workers of the world. There is not a limit, and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all its worth? And reaching out still got a perfection.
Is it also true, you kind of did a good job of describing your music background and the bands you were playing in, what you were listening to, and then this bridges over to David Dondero and some of this like folk punk stuff. Is it also true that you had sort of a more like more adjacent to some of the like the country roots of your music you'd play later happening in your family?
Yeah, my dad is the was a bluegrass and folk musician, and he has written songs for Newgrass Revival and for Alison Krauss, his whole entire life is dedicated basically to being a songwriter, and so I had a lot of roots in bluegrass music just kind of like everywhere when I was growing up. I spent
And
a
was
lot of
that
time.
when you're playing in those early bands, those loud bands and stuff, is that kind of percolating in the background all the time? Like, was it always there in you, or did you come back around to it? How?
Yeah. So once I made it to like past like my like it's only punk and hardcore punk phase, which is like I think from the time I was like 12 to like 16 or 17, I was like, I only like, you know what I mean? Like punk music.
Yeah.
And like, for example, it's like it took me probably like 100 listens to like Firehose. the Minutemen, because it's like so not
Yeah.
like that. But when you're young back then, you'd buy a record and you like didn't have the internet to go on and buy other records. So you just keep listening to this record that you spent your hard, earned money on or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, and listening
Yeah.
to it and listening to it and listening to it and listening to it. And like, so you like have these like weird albums that I would still like. But like mostly I only really wanted to listen to like punk music. And then when I was like 16 or 17 is I believe when I started kind of getting into metal more. I mean, like I was into like Metallica and Slayer like when I was a young punk. But like when I was like 16, 17 is when I like started getting into like stuff like His Hero Is Gone, like all the Prank Records stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with any of this like Southern, like kind of like crusty hardcore that like started becoming kind of like very prevalent in the late 90s. But like I got into that and Johnny Cash's album Cash, the very first one, like the very first, I mean, the very first American Recordings came out. And my brother had been like kind of bumping Johnny Cash and Hank Williams and like Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings and stuff like that. And I was basically given this sort of gift of imagining these like old country singers in this like very punk lens. You know what I mean? And it made me like start to be like, well, I liked all that stuff when I was growing up. You know what I mean? Like it was everywhere when I was growing up. And when I was a teenager, I didn't want anything to do with this stuff. But these artists are different. It's like I kind of like started putting them into like other categories. You know what I mean? Like where it's like outlaw country, like these old singers, they were punk. You know what I mean? That made me start, I started really sort of getting into like in the late 90s into Delta blues. And you know what I mean? Like, and I started listening to a lot of like emo records. Like I started getting into like more melodic stuff alongside. I mean, I like was one of the very few crusties that I knew who was like kind of obsessed with like the Get Up Kids and Saves the Day, and people were like, why do you like that garbage? And I'd be like, they write really good songs, like it's really catchy.
I listened to you on a pretty good podcast from like maybe it might have been 10 fucking years ago, which is crazy. I was searching through and you were talking about playing like Chuck Reagan revival tour type thing and going up and playing some, I think it was Get Up Kids. I think it was with Matt Pryor, right? And
Yeah,
maybe
it was me.
you and Frank Turner going up and
Yeah,
playing
yeah,
on some songs.
yeah.
But I was struck because it's funny the way we talk about emo music has evolved so much over the years that like that time 10 years ago it was basically like kind of talking almost purely in like this music that everyone was thought was like extremely lame or whatever. But I think that they've like evolved into like iconic and beloved status entirely now.
Well, maybe not entirely. I think there are still people who are like the jury's out on like for them, they're like, no, that stuff is not very good.
You're from
And
cooler music scenes than me, honestly. You can
that
tell.
maybe yeah, I'll allow you to I'll let that pass, sure. But yeah, I was really taken with like the songwriting and like all those bands like were putting out acoustic records also, and so when I discovered David Dondero. And then I discovered Jason Molina, Songs Ohio. You know what I
Amazing.
mean? Like it's like
Amazing.
that just like completely brought it all into focus. You know what I mean? Like with my background as like the son of a folk musician. You know what I mean? Like and then also like having become a fan of outlaw country and hard country as well. And then like getting into melodic punk songwriters and stuff like that. And they were doing acoustic stuff too. And it's like, it really, in some ways, gave me permission to like bust out my acoustic guitar and start writing songs. You know what I mean? Like, and I have to like be honest about it because like I had a background in like acoustic music. I had a background in in folk and bluegrass and stuff as a result of my family. But like, I was coming out of being a teenager and like, it's like it took a few years before I was like able to like really be like, can I be a punk? You know what I mean? Like, and also, you know what I mean? Like, make melodic music, like, and is it okay to play my acoustic guitar? And all of this kind of came along the same time as like me having ruined my voice screaming in bands as the lead singer. and I'd always been a good singer when I was a kid. When like I realized that I couldn't sing anymore, it was really kind of devastating. So I like quit screaming in bands, and I like set about learning to sing again. And I set about basically like writing songs that I would be able to sing. And at first I thought I was going to have like a band, like some sort of punk band. And I did for a while. I had a band called K10 Prospect, and we played with Against Me a couple of times. That was in like 2001 to 2004. That band was around. But in that time period, I was like adjacently also kind of like writing acoustic songs. And I moved to Prague in 2003 in the Czech Republic. And that's like really when like I realized I was like, okay, I'm doing this, you know what I mean? Like this other thing, because I moved there and my band, K10 Prospect, came to Europe and we did a European tour while I was there, but I didn't have anybody to play with for like 6 months.
Right.
And so I was just kind of like hanging out by myself with the guitar, writing and writing and writing.
And we rock because it's us against, and we found our own reasons to sing. And it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that, when people are either consumers or revolutionary, enemies or friends, hanging on to the fringes on the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns, talking like they're going to war.
It sounded like this very, very human music coming from a human being that is a punk band, which, you know, you can't say about Bad Religion or Anti-Flag or whatever. They sound like this, like distorted palm muted bands that are, and these were the bands I was listening to at the time. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of was like, holy shit, that exists. You can do that.
Yeah.
Like kind of like flipped a switch on that just never came off for me.
I can see why that would happen. By the time like a band like Anti-Flag showed up, you know, like they were political. I liked their politics, although clearly Justin is an awful rancid piece of shit. like, I always was like, this is mall punk politics. Like, I'm glad it's political and that people are like listening to it and like getting politicized by it. But like, this is like, I was like, this is not cool.
Absolutely.
Like, to, it was, you know, like, and cause I was in like a scene that was, it's a dickish thing. I'm always like trying to pretend like crust punk is like elevated in some way. And in a lot of ways, I feel like it's elevated from other genres of music in certain ways, like at least in my own mind. But the truth is that like, I just very pretentiously was like, what I like is way cooler than everybody else. Like a lot of people.
Well, what's funny, I mean, I think if you're of that world, like that's going to shape part of who you are and everything. And like, I wasn't of that world. And I remember seeing Anti-Flag on a show with like, who knows what other bands, like Less Than Jake and stuff, and hearing it. And I'm coming from a different perspective and still thinking like, oh, this is the mall put together a political band, like the banter between songs and everything. It was just sort of was like, okay, guys, we fucking get it. But then, and I don't know, I think what I'm trying to get at too is like, you can hear the metronome happening and everything, right? Like you don't hear that on Reinventing Axl Rose. Reinventing Axl Rose, I was listening through and it's got 11 songs on it, and only three of them start with like the full band coming in together. They either start with a voice alone or a guitar doing something. And it's like, fucking cool because it's this bridge between a band that wasn't a full band and a band becoming a full band. Like that's what that record is, and makes sense that you're starting these songs with the guitar, you're starting with the whatever, you know. It just felt so viscerally human in a way.
Tell me, how could you compromise yourself like this? Tell me, how could you blame anyone else when you aren't really committed? Tell me, where was your head when you broke that promise to yourself? The one where you just forget the reality of it happened before your rest of your time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. Well, I think that, let's be honest, it has the second worst snare tone of any record after Saint Anger in the history of fucking recorded music. But like,
I want to talk about that. Keep going.
But yeah, we can talk about that later. I did want to at least like bring it up because it deserves to be brought up. It is very human sounding, and like, it's so fucking catchy. Like even without having super concise verse chorus, you know what I mean? Like, structures all the time. It's like, I remember the first time I heard like Pints of Guinness, And I'd heard a lot of the songs on that record I'd already heard before because they're on the acoustic EP and they're on Primus Forgiven by Against Me. And like, you know, right. It's like, you know, I like, but when like that song came on, I was like, I got goosebumps. I was like, this is such a fucking well-written song, you know, like, and by the time like that record came out, I think it came out in like 2002 or 2003. I don't remember exactly what year it was out. I remember playing with them in Spokane, Washington on that tour, but I don't remember the year that it came out, but that was in 2003. So I don't know if it was like, if it had already been out. I just don't remember.
I think it's exactly. 01. 01 is Axl Rose. 02 is Disco Before the Breakdown. 03 is Eternal Cowboy. I think.
Is that right? I remember Eternal Cowboy came out when I was living in Prague. So that could have been in 2003, but I definitely saw them played with them before Disco Before the Breakdown came out, or maybe it was like right after that came out. It's so hard.
Anyway,
it's
been really long. I could.
Yeah, right. It doesn't matter.
You're talking about how catchy it was and seeing them.
Yeah, I mean, it's so catchy and so anthemic, but it's not necessarily following this like verse chorus structure. But I remember like just being really, really taken with like the songwriting and how like smart the words were. We just work until the day we decide we've had enough. All along, we'll stop to be honest. I came from a background of songwriting, and I always expected more from the lyrical content of the bands that I liked, you know? Like they had to either like be really like, you know, really good poetry, you know what I mean? Like that, like hinted at things, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. but was really cleverly put together, or hyper literate, or just so insanely catchy. It's like one of my favorite bands is the Go-Go's. It's like, you know, are all of their songs like intelligently written? Many of them are, but you know what I mean? Like, but a lot of it's like kind of just well-constructed, really smart fucking pop. You know what I mean?
For sure.
And like,
my wife gets into punk music as I get her into things, which so she, there's a lot of, anyway, we took a road trip one time and she was driving and I was going to fall asleep. And she's like, all right, put on the Go-Go's. And I was like, I hadn't really listened to the Go-Go's. And I just like pulled it up and was like, put it on. And I was going to go to sleep. And as it played for a while, I was like, I swear to God, Bianca, are the Go-Go's like a punk? There's like something here adjacent. There's something adjacent to punk music here. She's like, I don't know. I just fucking love, like, I love the Go-Go's. And I hadn't listened to them. And like, I, after that, fell in love with the Go-Go's.
I mean, you know that they were a punk band.
They
like,
were,
they
yeah.
Were like, they were a very, very early success story in punk music, you know, yeah. Like coming out of like the 80s hardcore scene, you know, like, I mean, DJ Bonebreak from fucking X was like Belinda Carlisle's drummer before.
I think I was listening to X right at that time. And that's, I was like, dude, this is so, maybe this is slightly catchier and slightly more polished than that. But this is like, it was this revelatory moment where even she was like, I guess they are punk band.
That's the thing that I always was aware of as a Go-Go's fan. Like, I got into them through a girlfriend in like 94, 95. This like Return to the Valley of the Go-Go's compilation, like 2-disc compilation came out. Yeah. And it had all the records on it. It had a bunch of B-sides and rarities. And like, and it had like demos from like their early days, live recordings from like the late 70s, you know what I mean? Like early 80s. So I was like aware of the fact that I was like, oh yeah, the Go-Go's were a punk band that just got the pop sheen. I've always been like had a soft spot for punk bands that like that make their first like pop record. You know what I mean? Like, and how like just how awesome and urgent it still feels, but then like polished and clean. It's one of the reasons why New Wave is like one of my favorite Against Me records, but that's another subject entirely.
Yeah, I feel that. Well, to go to something with the lyrics, I felt similar. The previous two seasons of this show are about Jackson Browne and Bright Eyes. Just starting with Evelyn sits by the elevator door. It's been 37 years since James died. Like, there's not a cliche to be found in that. Something about the start of that record is that snare drum beat, that set of like guitar and lyrics coming in, and then the cover of the record. Like that three, one, two, three punch of those things is sort of just like, God damn, like what? It just like was arresting. I remember just very, very instantly feeling so taken by it. And lyrics had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, the lyrics are phenomenal on that record. There's just no question.
In Tranny, they talk a lot about like, there's a lot of like pulling from Laura Jane Grace's journals and stuff like that. And I was just stunned by how often like full sentences were just turned into lyrics, like full sentences with no cadence of rhyme or anything. We're just like, yep, that's a lyric. Fully wholesale intact, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So you have this, the side A of the record you made is from Reinventing Axl Rose. Side B pulls from a few other spots. How'd you go about deciding what to, I want to come back to this full record in a minute, but like, how did you go about picking what you wanted to play? How hard was that?
Originally, I was just going to do Pints of Guinness and we're just going to be Pints of Guinness and Baby, I'm an Anarchist at first as an EP. I thought like it would be fun release a 7-inch with just those two songs or whatever.
Right.
And so even going back further to the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was doing streaming stuff, I was like trying to come up with a different thing to do. And one of the ones that I did, I called it Reinventing Axl Rose, you know, like, and where I played a bunch of the songs off of Reinventing Axl Rose. And then I also did like a Lucero cover. I did a Hot Water Music cover. I did, you know what I mean? Like,
cool.
Some different stuff, like that was genre topical, you know what I mean?
Right.
I did This Bike as a Pipe Bomb song too. Anyway, I basically made a joke about how I was gonna like do an album called Reinventing Axl Rose on the heels of that. And Laura was like, I would love to hear that. Or so I'm not gonna lie, I would love to hear that or whatever. And I was just like, I'm gonna fucking do it then. And I literally was going to do just two songs. And we went into the studio and my band, basically like we all pretty much knew the songs already, you know, like, and we like kind of like got together and we were like kind of going through the songs and we were like, you know, what songs should we do? It was like, well, yeah, we'll do Pints and we'll do Baby, I'm an Anarchist. And then people were like, we got to do Julie. You know what I mean? Like, we got to do it. So we did it all for Dawn. You know what I mean? Like, and it was like, oh yeah. You're right. And then like, if we're going to do it, we did it all for Dawn. I was like, then that gets off of Reinventing Axl Rose. I was like, that gives us license to do whatever we want. And it was like a grab bag within the week that we recorded the record.
Cause baby, I'm an anarchist. You're a spineless liberal. We march together for the 8-hour day and hell ends in the streets of Seattle. When it came time to throw bricks through that stone.
We recorded it in like 2 days. And so it was like, what do we know? Oh, we're just like pulling it out of the hat. And like, for example, Black Me Out was like a really like, was an easy one to want to do because it's like such a great song and it's pretty easy. You know what I mean? Like, it's like three chords through the whole dang thing.
You like unearthed something in that song to me as you like, I know it's a pretty straightforward song, but it plays that little riff at the beginning of theirs. And yours is just sort of played as like the little like blues progression kind of to come in. And it's like, you just see what's at the core of that song, which is just a fucking perfect song that I have to imagine is a fun one to play together live and stuff.
Oh my God. Like that one is like always the best one. Like in the few shows that I've done this, like so far, it's like people just like go nuts and like, and it's just so much fun to play. It's so driving.
Black me out. I'm pissed on the walls of your house. I'm gonna chop those brass rings off your fat fucking fingers. As if you're the kingmaker. As if, black me out.
But yeah, it's like, that's like that. And then also like Sink Floor to Sink, which I always imagined as a country song. I just was like, this is a fucking country song.
There's some brilliant thing about zagging away from this thing that is just like the only way I've ever heard it is a bunch of people all singing together drunkenly. And you go a different direction and you don't do the thing that a bunch of bands have needed to do, probably covering songs forever.
Seal it in an envelope addressed to your last known residence. Ooh.
completely honest with you, when you hear a song you know that they're going to be covered, you expect at some point to be made kind of like, no, that's not the way this song's supposed to go. And mm-hmm. you pulled 8 songs together that don't do that for me. They like give me this like loud and rowdy music that I've loved and delivered in this other like kind of shimmering tremolo country music. It's great.
Thank you. I consider myself first and foremost to be a punk. Like I identify as a punk person, you know, yeah. Like, and it's like, I'm, you know, like I'm also queer and non-binary and like, and I'm also a country singer, you know what I mean? Like, but these are things that like are core. I'm a punk first and like an anarchist second, you know what I mean? Like, and then like a country singer after that, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm like, it's like, if I go through like my core, you know what I mean? Like personality traits, the things that like I really find that define me and have always sort of defined me, you know what I mean? As a person, it's like I'm these things first. But it's like, in saying that, it's like, I am a country singer. And so when I hear songs that are presented a certain way and I like imagine them and fantasize about like what they could be, because I do that sometimes, it's like, I just heard that, you know what I mean? Like I heard that from those songs, you know, like, and I always kind of heard that from those songs. I mean, like Baby I'm an Anarchist is fucking O'Donna. by Richie Valens. I mean, it's a bunch of other songs too, but it's like, of all of the songs that like that progression is to me, it's like O'Donna was a huge deal because I was really into Richie Valens when I was a kid. Like La yeah. Bamba came out when I was like 7 years old or something like that, and like I was obsessed with it. You know, like. So, or maybe I was younger. I don't remember. but it's like, I was really obsessed with that.
You leaned into the O'Donna, Angel Baby, that kind of feeling of that song. Mm-hmm. That is, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Just sitting there anytime you hear that song, like, oh yeah, that's what that is.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I kind of, since I like could hear that already, I was like, well, I'm just going to take it to its furthest point. Because at first we were like, well, what do we do? Like, how do we want to do these songs? And like, there was a couple of like moments where they were like, well, maybe we should just do them like kind of like Americana rock songs, like the way that like maybe you do things, right? You know what I mean? Like a lot of the time. And I was like, honestly, I don't see it. I was like, I think we really need to like push it into a totally different sonic area. You know what I mean? Like, and just yeah. make it like this other thing. And I was like, I've always heard these songs as country songs. I was like, so like, let's just do it. And that's why, like, I always tell people that it's like, I turn the songs into hard country songs, because it's like, you know, kind of like full stop hard country. It's just, it's country, you know, like,
yeah. Is there any poetry to you all recording it in 2 days, just as Against Me recorded this record in 2 days and recorded that?
I hadn't even thought about it. Honestly, like I don't think about that type of synchronicity, I suppose, you know, like, now that you say it, that's, I have to contemplate it. Maybe it just like, it was just an easy thing to do for us. You
true.
Know?
I'm a strong believer in like the good things that can come from like constraints and limitations and stuff like that. And I don't think it's coincidental that reinventing Axl Rose is what it is, because it was $750 over 2 8-hour days, where the first day got borderline scrapped because they felt like they got too excited and played the songs too fast and stuff.
Yeah.
And if you say that the original plan was to come in and cut 2 songs, and then people started thinking about other songs and then it became the thing that it was, like, I think there's something to that. There's something organic that extends out of that, you know?
I mean, I think that that's probably true. I mean, you know, maybe it's important to note that like we were sort of fighting back against whether or not we were going to do it just like a few songs. And then we're like, okay, well, let's make a 4-song EP. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And then we were like, well, I mean, we already got like the bones of like those 4 songs. It was like, well, I mean, we'll like make it a 6-song EP. It was like, well, we're already at 6 songs and we could, you know what I mean? Like we could do this song and this song, you know, like, and it was like, all right, let's go for it. You know, like, and then all of a sudden we had 8 songs and we're like, oh, well, we have an LP. That's funny. You know, like we started with like, you know, really, really low expectations, like, you know, and the studio that we recorded at, like, was just like, You know, like, it's like really good friend of mine named Jake Belzer, who owns a studio called Primary Sound Studio here in Bloomington. Well, I called him up and I asked him if we could come in and record some songs. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, I don't have anything coming in, going on. Like, what days do you want to do it? And we were like, well, I guess we could do it like these days, you know, like in a couple of weeks. And he was like, fuck yeah. You know, like, you've got a couple of days. I needed like another person to sing. And so he like went over a list of like who we should have sing. And he was like, maybe this person. And I was like, I don't know. And I was like, how about this person? I'm like, oh, like different like women around Bloomington. Cause I wanted somebody, you know, like I wanted a feminine voice like on the record as well, as I often always like to have a feminine voice on all my records as well. Yeah. And we were like going through it. It's like, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. And he's like, hey, hold on a second. He's like, do you know Jen Christie? And I was like, that name sounds familiar. And he was like, well, you probably know her because she's like John Mellencamp's backup singer forever, you know? Like, and I was like, oh yeah, okay, yeah. She does like some like big like kind of budget tribute like stuff. And he was like, yeah, totally, that's the one. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. I was like, you think she's available? He was like, I don't know. We'd send her a text and like she showed up like later that day.
Did she know Against Me, or did she get introduced to Against Me through that?
Totally got introduced to Against Me through this. Yeah.
Fun. Yeah, that's so cool. That's going to be a funny thing where she can go check out Against Me and she's going to have your original your version like there with her that she sung on.
Yeah, I mean, the first one that she heard was Baby I'm an Anarchist, and she was just like, this song is so cool. She was like, is this your song? And I was like, no, this is a band called Against Me. It's actually, they're like a punk band and I'm like doing their songs like in a different way. And she was like, wow, it's a really, really fun thing. Like, that's awesome. And yeah, we had a really good time. And she ended up playing like organ on Black Me Out and, you know, like different stuff. It was fun. Great.
Yeah, I read a thing. It was interesting. I was reading. It was saying that like, yeah, Baby I'm an Anarchist was a cover of sorts. And then the way they elaborated after, at first I interpreted that as it's O'Donna. Like, you mm-hmm. know, like it's our own song written to O'Donna. But then what they were talking about was Laura Jane Grace wrote it in a previous band, like with some other people. And kind of was like in this little intermediate period for Against Me was like, oh, I don't know if I don't want to take it from this band, but Against Me was kind of becoming her main project. And then eventually was like, okay, we'll do it as an Against Me song. And then the girl they call in to sing on that is from that previous band they wrote with. So that's why that kind of happened. So then I was like, well, did they mean then that it was a cover of a song written in a previous band done by the same musician? I don't know. It's probably the O'Donna thing, but
that's a very good question to which I think it's clear that neither of us have an answer to.
We don't. All right. Drum sound. I've heard the talk of the snare sound. I have to say, like, I haven't had as much time in a studio. I'm not like a super like sophisticated gear person, any of this stuff. But to me, it's sort of like the sound is what the sound is. I don't mind the snare sound. Would you, here's the question I would ask. Would you want the snare changed and fixed? Would you want a version of it with a different snare sound?
Absolutely.
You would want the equivalent of fucking George Lucas going in and putting in digital Star Wars guys into his movies in like the late 90s. That's to me what it is.
I don't think it's the same thing at all. That said, like, I only anecdotally hear the same snare sound when I listen to it, you know, like, yeah. It doesn't like piss me off at all. I definitely remember when the record came out being like, whoa, that snare tone is a lot. You know what I mean? Like, but like getting past it, it's a funny thing. Cause I honestly think that it's cool when bands like decide to re-record songs and and try to like do different stuff. I mean, like, think about like, I mean, this isn't like relevant to you, but just like, people like Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash like re-recorded the same songs, like, you know what I mean, over and over again. They recorded each other's songs in multiple versions. They did them like for themselves. They did them as duets. They did, you know, it's like,
that's relevant to me. That I love. That's good to me. That's like, for whatever reason, whether it's time, whether it's reinterpreting, whether it's anything, you're doing your song again. I don't know. When I go through, this could be that I could be fucking myself over with this, but when I go through to listen to music and I see the original version that was made and I see the remixed and remastered version, I go to the original one because I'm sort of like, I want the thing that was plucked from like a fossil from a specific time, like There's some charm to that. I think it's very funny. Like Warren, I was described the snare. The snare was actually just a little wooden tambourine that had a head on top and bottom, but it had little tambourine jingle every time you hit it. He's kind of laughingly talking about this little like drum kit that he could like nest inside its kick drum and like mm-hmm. take the drum set from somewhere and like sitting next to him in a car seat, like driving around Florida or whatever. I think it's just funny and charming, you know, but I also think it's bad, but I think it's good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you. When you said like, would I replace the entire snare drum? I'm going to say yes, because I want to hear that, you know, why not? I'm not saying that I think they should like do a remastered, you know what I mean? Like edition or whatever necessarily. But if they did it, I would definitely go and listen to it on like Spotify or whatever and be like, huh? Cause this snare drum is the thing of punk lore. You know what I mean? Like this is like such a fucking like hotly contested, often like, you know what I mean? Like romanticized or like marginalized thing. You know what I mean? Like it's like everyone has an opinion on it. All the musicians that I know have an opinion on it.
For sure. Least,
you know? And like, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't think that we need to go back in time and change the snare drum tone. I'm glad that the snare tone is the way that it is, just if nothing else, because we can laugh about it and talk
it's
about
fun,
it.
Yeah.
But it is like, you know, one of the worst snare tones ever. And like I said, the only worst snare tone in recorded musical history is Metallica's Saint Anger.
It was a bad.
Like, we understand why, like, we have the reasons for why the Against Me snare tone is what it is and budget and that drum set and everything. Do we know why that Saint Anger one is like that?
I don't know. Really, really bad production choices for a band that was, like, trying to stay relevant and thought that, like, they needed to be a new metal band all of a sudden.
That's probably, you know? You probably just succinctly nailed that. Exactly. That's probably exactly
what I mean, I know that that's what it is. They were very cynically trying to, like, keep up with the times. Maybe not even cynically, just... that's what they were doing. They were trying to keep up with the times and stay relevant. And like, they thought that they could model morph themselves. I mean, they had sort of done it successfully, like during the alternative period in the 90s with Load and Reload. And like, so it makes sense that they would think to themselves, like, you know, like maybe we can harness this thing. I mean, it was actually too late. It was like nu metal was already over basically. And they finally did it. But it's like,
I was in college when Saint Anger came out with a couple of roommates who were really into Metallica, and I didn't grow up on it. And I went to a Metallica concert around that time and remember
Saint Anger very, very adeptly stumbled, you know what I mean? Like in a almost comically way, especially with like the Some Kind of Monster documentary that showed them to be total fucking a-holes. And don't get me wrong, I think that probably they're all really nice people. I've got friends who are friends with them. Like, and they like speak very highly of members of Metallica, mm-hmm. you know, like as like human beings, like, and as friends. So I'm not like, you know, I'm not trying to like die on a hill here, or trying to talk right. shit about Metallica.
But I will say
that this, like this period of Metallica was a huge, huge, like they just like, they expertly fumbled the ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, they like almost, like they, it's like they did it so well. They fucked up so well that it was almost like they did it on purpose.
I don't know shit about Metallica, but I saw Metallica on that tour at the Cow Palace in the Bay Area with Godsmack. and remember just being, they did a thing where they were on like, the Cow Palace is like a big ag place and you're all on dirt on the ground. And the stage mm-hmm. rotated one 360 degree rotation over the like 3 hour set. So it was like not enough to perceive it, but enough to like realize like, oh, he's over there now. And which is not good if you're like high and drunk on whiskey and sort of like, it just really disorienting, really messed me up. But it's cool. Anyway, snare sound. Last thing on that. I just love that it's such a thing of lore, and like the whole band has their feelings about it and everything. And it's not like it. It's like literally the first notes you hear on the record in like one of their most iconic songs is that thing. That's just perfect.
Totally.
Just a perfect little thing.
Again, I love and hate the snare tone on that, you know, like, and you're right. It fits the recording. I don't know what I would do without it, but I would like to hear it.
I would too. Someone's got to be able to get the stems and do that. Do you have like, I mean, you, it's a weird question to ask because you have five of the songs on the record you made, but any specific songs on this record that just mean a lot to you or jumped out to you, or just that you, it's kind of a broad question, but,
you know, I mean, Pints of Guinness is one of my favorite songs, period, like in recorded musical history. That was like when I really went from being like a passive fan to being like an active fan, you know, like I had liked them. I'd seen them play, and like Crime Is Forgiven by Against Me, I was like, it took a long time for that to grow on me. And I still don't turn back to it like ever. You know what I mean? Like I never like feel like I got to listen to that record. The acoustic like record really like drew me in, and I remember I was like listening to it like on a rotation like in a CD player.
And then sits by the elevator doors. It's been 37 years since James died on St. Patrick's Day in 1964. She could not.
I was addicted to this game Civilization. My friends had like a, you know, a CD player with like a 5-disc changer, and like and the acoustic EP was in there, and like Sunvolt Trace was in there, and like I loaded it, you know, like because I was like hanging out, but like it was taken from their like record collection, you know, and like and the first Songs of Ohio record was there, and like and I like loaded in like David Dondero Shooting at the Sun with a Water Gun. So it's like a very formative bunch of records just like in there, you know what I mean? Like, and I was like playing this game, and it's like that acoustic EP like really grew on me, you know what I mean, as a result. But like, it wasn't until Reinventing Axl Rose came out and I heard like Pints that I was just like blown away. Like I got goosebumps, you know? And of course I misheard the words, which is funny because that's actually, I sent like Laura that song first, you know, like, cause it was the one that was done first. And she was like, you changed quite a few of the lyrics. And I was like waiting for her to be like, you know what I mean? Like be like, what the fuck? And, but then she was like, I actually think that it like works better in a lot of ways, the way that you changed it. And I was like, yeah, I didn't really mean to. I just, that's how I remembered them, you know, like when we were there.
So you just played and sang those songs from what your version of memory was.
Yeah, basically. There was a couple that I like went and had to like look. Like, for example, We Did It All for Dawn is like, that's the main example. I wanted to change the words to Baby, I'm an Anarchist to like make it more current also. Yeah. So like I went and like looked at the the actual words because I wanted to like make sure that the like rhyming scheme, you know what I mean, like held true or whatever.
Yep.
Which it didn't, but it, you know, I just like kept the same rhymes basically with it. I actually had a version where I like completely like rewrote a lot of it to make it completely current, and I almost did that version, but I was like, nah.
I bet your version would be better, not than Against Me, but better than Fall Out Boy trying to do We Didn't Start the Fire. Did you see this the other day?
I didn't see that, no.
That song is just spouting off things that happened, like events that happened, and they did sort of like a modernized version of that. Yeah, give it a listen. It's tough.
Harry Potter, Twilight, Michael Jackson dies, nuclear accident, Fukushima, Japan.
I mean, it's probably bad enough to be entertaining to the point that it seems on purpose to get someone to pay attention to it on the internet, which then maybe boomerangs us back to maybe you shouldn't listen to it, to not fall victim to that. Because I did.
Yeah, I might remember to listen to it, but it's likely I won't. Because that I'm nothing if not forgetful. I have the memory, like the short-term memory of a goldfish. Like my ADHD is such that like I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah, no, your wallet. You lost your wallet today.
Yeah. The thing is I lost it yesterday, but I wasn't worried about it until today when I was like, it has not turned up anywhere, you know, like, and then I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to like really retrace my steps.
Did Against Me take on new meaning to you after Transgender Dysphoria Blues? Was there, you're non-binary and you've talked a lot about a lot of these kinds of things. And I don't know, does that record have anything, any extra meaning to you, or did it give extra meaning to Against Me, or?
Well, I think that's a really good question. Honestly, like, you know, at the time, these weren't things that I was really thinking about too much. It took a lot of years for me to like learn like slowly but surely more and more about transness and like what it means. And I would say that like I'd known some trans folks growing up and like sort of like passively known them, but Laura was the first person that I was like acquaintances with, you know what I mean, that I actually like knew somewhat, who came out as trans. And at first it like a lot of people, it blew my mind. And that time period, what year was the interview in Rolling Stone?
It was either 2013, I think. It might be 12 or 14, but the idea that's nearly 10 years ago is wild, and I can vividly remember reading that.
It happened before I went on tour in Australia for sure, and that was in the beginning of 13, so it had to have been no later than 2012.
I think you're right, so, actually. I think it's 12.
Yeah. That was, I would say that there was like a few really important moments in my interactions with friends and fans on the internet, you know what I mean, like where that would like set the tone for the trajectory that I ended up being on. And I could say that like that might have been like the first most significant one, because in 2011 I went on tour with Willie Nelson, like on this thing called the Country Throwdown, and it had like Willie Nelson and Jamie Johnson and Brantley Gilbert and Lee Bryce, like, you know, had like some really good people on it and some really shitty like commercial country shit. So I had been kind of exposed to like this kind of like wider world of country music, and like had been picked up by like some of the like outlaw country kind of adherent people. And I remember when Laura came out as trans, I chimed in on it about how I supported her. And it was like the first time that I ever said something online where people were like, fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, really? And I had, there was like this like really short lived Twitter account that I think was trying to be like Jaded Punk Hulk. I don't know if you remember that or not, but it was like a really funny Twitter account that was around for a while. But it was called like something Ass Kissers, like Seamster Ass Kissers. And like, they like basically like retweeted my tweet and tried to call me out for like kissing Laura's ass. And I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Laura is my colleague. You know what I mean? Like, we both have toured on the Revival tour. I've known her since like 2000 or 2001. You know what I mean? Like, maybe not as an actual friend, but like, I've known her, you know what I mean? Like, at least of her, and been in rooms with her since this time period. I was like, so how is it like kissing somebody's ass by just saying, I support this person.
Everything you got to hold on to. Everything you lied on to me. That feels too bad to fuck. The skeleton alone, the egg in the gallows of your heart. None with this one, and where are your friends? Please help me through these years ahead. Are we just drinking bodies flying with
that was like the first time, and then in like, you know, 2015, like, I like released a shirt that was that said, like, love country music, hate racism, you know, like, and adjacent to that, like, came out really hard in support of getting rid of the Confederate flag. Or I should say, I came out very hard against the Confederate flag, and that actually lost me like hundreds, if not thousands, of followers within like a couple of days.
Is this, you know, like, is this because... just? Do you think this is just like certain people's ability to listen to music that sounds like country music or whatever and just hear what they want to hear in it and not? I always find it baffling when I'm like, can't you kind of tell what the person stands for already to a certain degree? It always kind of stuns me.
Yeah, I mean, look, people stay stupid, all right? And like, and whether it's like willful or like, you know, or just passive, you know, like, you know, for example, I'm going to talk about something actually here. So let's take Frank Turner as like a case point. I think that anybody will listen to Frank Turner and get whatever the fuck, you know what I mean, like, out of his lyrics that they feel themselves.
Yeah.
And that means that like, if you fall in more of like a left-wing spectrum, you're going to hear it, you know what I mean, like, and assume that Frank is like a leftist. And if you fall on a right-wing spectrum, you're going to hear it and assume that Frank is right-wing. And that is like sort of the genius of Frank, you know what I mean? Like, in a way, is that he writes words that everybody just sort of universally can relate to and see themselves in.
Bruce Springsteen does this, right? It's sort of a, you can find yourself in it. Yeah. No, what do you hear when you hear Frank Turner?
I've always had like a okay relationship with Frank, but I know that like, we definitely don't see eye to eye on like a lot of political things.
I don't want to be like the type of person that's like, can't we all just get along or whatever? But like, at the end of the day, every human being is going to be their own individual self. It's a matter of like some level of truth and sincerity. And obviously certain beliefs are just fully revolting, but I don't know. It's definitely not coming out that way in his lyrics. I will say that the next person I'm interviewing for this is Frank Turner. So haven't done that yet, but another person I'm excited to talk to about Against Me. Another example of this is like, what you're kind of describing about what people were saying in your support of Laura Jane Grace after that. This is kind of like Jason Isbell. It seems like every day on Twitter is just Jason Isbell talking to a fan who didn't know that Jason Isbell felt the way he felt about certain political things. And you're sort of like, hello, like, it's fucking can't, how are you discovering this now? I don't really get it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that you have to be living under a rock in a lot of ways, but I think that like, for example, I grew up in the Midwest in Southern Indiana, and I come from like the cool college town or whatever, but I grew up outside of the college town, like in the woods. And my parents were like radical hippies, but nobody, you know, like that lived near to us had similar values to my family.
Yeah.
And my family, you know, is Jewish, which is like really weird thing to be in this part of the world, especially out in the country, you know what I mean? Like in Indiana. And, you know, like I experienced anti-Semitism like really early. I knew that I was queer really early, and fought against it really hard. You know, I had a lot of really difficult, hurtful conversations with myself, over the course of my life. But like, being punk, like by the time I was like 12, also like really set me at odds, you know, like with like the surrounding, you know, like kind of countryside that I was like growing up in. So like, hey, I'm really sorry, but what was the question again? Because for some reason, like I just lost the thread.
What was the question? I don't know. We got a couple threads going. Was I talking about like people misinterpreting the meaning of music?
Oh, okay. By the time like I got on the Revival tour in 2008, I was trying to figure out a way to conform to the people who were around me who were like very masculine, you know what I mean? Like Chuck Reagan,
yeah,
Tim Berry. And I really, really just wanted to be like kind of like one of the boys, you know.
Yeah, they're like literal they're like literal hunters and stuff, right?
They're man's men, you know, like, and you know, and there's actually a part in Tranny where Laura talks about like this as well, you know, and you know, I really wanted to be accepted and I wanted to have a career. And so like I slowly closeted myself after being openly bisexual in like, you know what I mean, like throughout my 20s. So I was quiet about things for a good amount of time. And I think that a lot of us, including like Jason Isbell, you know, like we're quiet about things for a long time. And it got to the point where, you know, I think a lot of us realized at different times, you know, that we came to it at different times, realized that like things were pretty fucked up. And unless we used our platforms that we had like put together to do some amount of good, that we would be doing a disservice to the world that we were in. Like, I have to say that, like, I think, and I know that I was like one of the first people who was kind of like in this like Americana scene, you know what I mean? Like to be like, start to be really open about my politics, and it hurt me really, really badly. And I always thought that it was pretty obvious. You know, I mean, I have a song, my first like, you know, record that kind of got, other than Bristle Ridge with Chuck Reagan, like that got any heat with Somebody Loves You. And the first lyrics of that are, "Easy there, old man, I'll drop you where you stand. You have wings of white, but I smell your hellfire. I know who you are, a racist and a coward." I just feel like if anybody didn't understand, you know what I mean? Like
where you're what coming I was, from. Yeah.
Where my perspective was, it's like, you're really fucking missing, you know, like the point. And like, I think it's easy to do that because people just like to listen. And most people don't even hear the words. Like, I honestly very much believe that people listen with their eyeballs a lot of the time. And like, they just sort of like go like, oh, this person is just like a country person, you know what I mean? Like, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're like rough around the edges, so they're an outlaw. And they just like throw it into this box.
For sure. There's no fucking doubt about it. Yeah.
I mean, like, I know this to be true because when I was like, when I was bigger, you know, like when I was like in the 240 to 270 range of like weight, like people would tell me that I sounded like Meatloaf or Frank Black from the Pixies or like John Popper from Blues Traveler.
Come on.
Or Jack Black.
This is what you mean by reading with your eyes. So they're
just seeing that I was fat, a fat person, and just equating it to whatever fat person that they had in their head. You know what I mean? Like, and I would just be like, I sound like literally none of these people.
You see this,
you know, like
you see this a lot in like the NBA when like a certain like white player is good or something, and then they just compare him to a white guy from 15 years earlier. You're like, you know, you don't know what you're doing right here, but certain things in your brain are connecting. And yeah, it's,
yeah. Damn. I mean, people are like, I love people. They're beautiful. And I'm a huge believer in human beings, you know? But people are not, they're not always taking in all the information and then making decisions based off of like the actual input that they're getting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that most people read into things the way, whatever it is that they have as a perspective already. And that like the only way to really like get past that is to like take time to educate yourself about the things that you're talking about. You know what I mean? Like, or the things you're confronting. I always got angry because when I like first started out in like, and I was like kind of picked up by this like burgeoning folk punk scene that was mostly just people from hardcore bands or emo bands or pop punk bands that like picked up acoustic guitars, you know, like I had already been doing it for so long, you know what I mean? Like, and came from like a background of that, that I would get really frustrated when people would talk about my records and like they would compare me to like other people that I sounded like literally nothing like, you know, like, and I would just be like, their musical vocabulary is just super limited.
No, I'm not.
not decisions about myself. And so that's why I know that people are out there all the time just making snap decisions, especially about people who are really good at writing songs that are like everyman songs. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they're really good. Jason Isbell is such a smart writer. You know, mm-hmm. like, he's really able to like write something that people are like, yep. Frank Turner is a really smart writer. He's able to do that too. You know, like, and it's like, hats off to people who are able to like write those types of songs, because that's why they're so successful, because they can write those types of songs. But even if they aren't, you know, we still see these cases of people getting angry at bands that are like, obviously, like Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah, that's,
you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
we've had a solid like half dozen like Republican politicians who are really into Rage Against the Machine. It's like, come on, do you get it? It's not even remotely hidden whatsoever. I mean, as long as you have like some slight level of like critical thought, you can even see that the band name itself is saying something.
Yeah, but the thing is that like divorcing like from the fact that we understand that the machine they're raging against is what it is. The fact that we are like culturally aware, because we know where they're like, you know what I mean? Like where their political allegiances lie. A lot of people, right-wing people, okay, so going off to another fucking subject, right-wing like politics is extremely adept at co-opting things that come from the left. They're really good. Whitewashing is a thing that they are excellent at, you know? And so like right now, I think especially, we are seeing the fruits of that labor and people thinking that the machine, right, you know what I mean? Like,
they slot in their own machine.
They're like, what? Yeah, I like cops. Cops are cool. They're, you know what I mean? Like this. And it's like, you know, I used to have a martial arts coach who was a police officer. And like, and one day I walked into the gym and he was in there by himself, like working out, and Rage Against the Machine was blasting. And like, as soon as he like got done with his workout, I was like, Rage Against the Machine, huh? You know? And he was like, oh yeah, they're one of my favorite bands. And I was like, you do realize that like their political content like definitely goes against everything you believe in, pretty much. Yeah.
They're saying words. Like, they're saying words in between those riffs, you know.
He was like, I know. He was like, I don't care. I just love them. And I looked at him and I was like, they don't love you. And he was like, I know. And like, and I was like, at least you know.
Yeah, that's,
you know what I mean? Like that's like that you're like into this band that like hates everything about what it is you do for a living. You know, my point is that like people just like things. They like what they like. And I think a lot of the time they especially like to think that what they like would like them. And I think that this is actually maybe the point that we've been angling towards. And I think that this is really the important meat of it. Like, and so I'm sorry for just blabbing and like, and having to get to here is that in order to get here. But like, the thing is that people want to believe that the things that they like would also like them. They want to have, you know what I mean? Like this, like, direct line of thinking where they're like, I could sit down and have a beer with this person. It's like the thing they talk about with like presidential candidates and different shit like that. It's like, oh, yeah, like I could have a beer with them, you know, like it's cool. This desire to see yourself, you know, like in all the things that you like. And so when something that you like is like, I don't like you. Hey, you? No, I don't want you as a fan. Bye. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, that is a bitter pill. And a lot of the time it only can be like swallowed when it's being shoved down your fucking throat. You know what I mean? Like when it's like,
yeah,
fuck you, you know,
it's true. Yeah.
Swallowed. Like,
I gotta say, when I see it happen online or whatever, I do find it amusing and entertaining to for someone to be like, well, that's it. I'm returning my two tickets to see you in St. Paul or whatever. And it's like, good, return them. Don't want you in St. Paul. See you later. Can't believe you couldn't hear my music before anyway. Well, this is like sort of adjacent. I want to let you go shortly, but the something you accomplish with this record is I like Against Me as I like Laura Jane Grace's songwriting. This podcast comes at it a lot from the direction of songwriting. Like the previous two seasons are about essentially singer-songwriters, which isn't necessarily the way you would describe Against Me, but it is a certain way that I do come at Against Me. Like I but it's, this is being screamed into microphones with sound, like besides the very first couple of records, it's something you've accomplished with this record is it kind of like allows those, that songwriting to shine in another way, the same way you'd hear someone play some song you love on an acoustic guitar only or whatever. On this record you've put out, it's sort of like musical accompaniment to the songs that were written, and it's a cool way to revisit them.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with you. I've always considered Against Me to be a singer-songwriter project that, like, you know, I mean, I can't say always, but for a very long time, I've considered it to be Laura Jane Grace and, like, the vehicle for her to present her songs for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, she's just sits in this space, you know what I mean, with other great writers. And to be honest with you, that's like one of the reasons why I wanted to do this record, because I haven't covered very many songs in my life. Like the number of songs that I've covered before this were like, you know what I mean? Like on one hand, basically.
Really? Dang.
And like, yeah, especially that like I've recorded, you know, like, and almost always they were for a very specific purpose. I mean, I did like a Weaker Than's cover, you know, like for a compilation of Weaker Than's songs. I did like, me and Frank Turner have a split 7-inch that like, where we like are each doing like different artists from different, or songs by different artists. He does Thunder Road by The Boss, and I do To Daddy by Dolly Parton. I've done a few. I got a Merle Haggard cover, like of Mama Tried with The Takers that I did, but it's like mostly I've only recorded my songs. You know, Laura Jane Grace is an important fucking writer.
Yeah.
And I think that most of the people who are going to listen to this, they're already probably aware of that. I look at Laura's songs as deep pieces of inspiration to my formation as a songwriter. Against Me was rising in popularity literally at the exact same time that I was like starting to write songs, you know what I mean? Like that were outside of like this, like, you know, like hardcore or metal punk paradigm. And some of the world will fall undead. Economics, history, math, and history. But it brings us round when you're the dead one. Take on such a thing as it is unbearable. Rules are changing if you're insane. When you're in the sense of living, there is always happens. Those songs meant something to me. They meant something to a lot of people. And I don't know if she's ever going to be like able to be in the boys club of rad songwriters that like everybody talks about how they're the greatest songwriters. If Laura weren't who she is, like, you know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but if she weren't who she is, I bet you that she would have been like uplifted in this, you know what I mean? Like same way much sooner. You know what I mean? Like, or have already been, I mean, I should say, you know, like, and I just like wanted to be like, I don't know, these songs are important to me. And I don't do this for like any, I've never done this for anyone before.
Right.
It's like so far out of my like realm of experience, you know, like, and yet it was like so seamless and easy.
The origin point of it is beautiful and pure and good. And I don't know, just like your project, this one that I'm doing all is also driven at trying to get at that songwriting side of things. So I don't know, maybe we're helping do our tiny little part in pushing that.
Sure, hope so. I mean, I think that like, if you, even if you don't like country music and you hear these versions, if you can't hear how easily they translate to a totally different genre.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and what that means for the universality, like the universality, universality.
I think it's good.
I think it's apparent. Regardless of whether you like the presentation or not, you should at least be able to tell that like, well, these songs can sit in a totally, totally different realm.
Absolutely.
You know, like, and that really is the essence of good songwriting. It's like, how do you present it? I don't know. We could present it however, and it's going to be a fucking good song.
Still stands. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. And it's not one you even have to put a rock solid thing on, but if you could only have one of their records forever, is Reinventing Axl Rose a record or something else? Or
I mean, probably, yeah. I would say that probably if I could only ever listen to one Against Me record again, it would probably be Reinventing. It's possible that I would choose New Wave I would say that New Wave is definitely my number two, if not number one, Against Me record. It's really hard though to quantify, because I love, like I said earlier in the interview, I love when a punk band makes their first pop record. I just like, you know, these are like, there are these records that are out there that, like, you know, you give a band that's never had a fucking big ass budget, you know what I mean? Like in like a studio with all the bells and whistles, you know, like, and you put them in there and they make this like confluence of like their sound with like pop sheen. And it just, to me, it produces some of the greatest results in like the history of recorded music. And I think we have like Out Come the Wolves by Rancid is one.
Yeah.
You know, like that's just an amazing record. Dookie by Green Day.
Yep.
Dear You by Jawbreaker. I mean, Nevermind by Nirvana. You know what I mean? Like,
that's,
it's
true,
just,
yeah,
you know, like these records are just, in my opinion, they're undeniable. And a lot of people, when they first came out, they hated the records because it like signaled this,
yep,
change. It was selling out, blah, blah, blah. I always like try to tell people that like my scene thought that Against Me sold out when they signed to Fat Records.
Yeah.
I heard people grumbling about them being on No Idea when Reinventing came out. You know, it's like, and that was like something that I was always kind of like, what?
It's literally
like when they signed to Fat, like I made jokes about it because Fat Records bands had budget and had money. And it's like, that was like some serious, especially back then, you're going to get some serious shit that like underground punk bands are not even remotely going to have.
You can see how it would eventually become like, fuck it, who cares if it's like you sold out when you made this record on No Idea and had fucking cymbals on your drums and stuff like that. And then
that is literally like the point I always made, like when people were like, fuck them for this or that, you know what I mean? Like, and when New Wave came out and people were like, oh, they sold out, I was like, listen, motherfucker, I was like listen, mall punk, who only discovered them when you know, Cavalier Eternal came out, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, listen, motherfucker, I was like, I'm sorry, but like the story of Against Me is like they're getting too big, they're selling out, you know, like, and like I watched it unfold in real time. I like participated in some small amount of shit talk, you know what I mean? Like, not ever with malice, but definitely like I made jokes when they signed to Fat Records, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but like more than anything, I like heard people talk shit about them like in every single era. And I was always like, I don't think it's that big of a deal. I also have the unique perspective of coming from a family that were musicians, where music literally fucking fed us and put food on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll do.
And
it.
Like,
that'll do.
And I always was kind of like, hey, if somebody wants to like make a living off of like playing music, I'm sorry, that's more punk than them like working at a corporate job. You know, like, and like, you can talk about it being like extractive, which it certainly is. And, you know, you can talk about like, you know, about how it fucks up the culture and makes the culture commodifiable. You know what I mean? Like, there are all sorts of different arguments to be had about like, for example, the path that they ended up taking. But like, at the end of the day, it's like, people are mad at you and they stay mad at you for having success in the punk scene.
Yeah.
This is actually a thing that I would get so irate about because, you know, Against Me's Crime Is Forgiven by Against Me came out on Planet X Records, and their slogan was, if it ain't cheap, it ain't punk. And I would just be like, listen, like I played this show with my band in a van, you know what I mean? That needs to have gas in it in order to move. And you're handing me like, you know, $7, a paperclip, a cigarette, and like fucking two beers, because that's what you got from the door. And there's like 40 people here. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
and I was
just
like,
no,
I'm sorry, but like for like a kid who grew up like on food stamps with like starving artist parents, seeing punks who like were like, we shouldn't have to pay for this. You know what I mean? It's like, and I was just be like, what the fuck? How do you think that they're gonna get to the next place?
We want a band who plays hard at heart every night. That doesn't care how many people got it at the door. Don't try to hold one man miles and have another, but it played out to the cliffs and rest. The side chords, the time like a knife. Means something's more than t-shirt or thinking something. There was something I'm short of massacre. And every woman living with a memory of someplace else in the world.
there's no exact perfect spot that Against Me stops and satisfies everybody. There's someone saying you should be bigger and someone saying you already sold out at every juncture along that path. And I've kind of made a point going into this to not listen to those records. So I'm going to take them one by one as I go and relive like how I did that. Cause I know just like you, I had my own, I pick it up at right after this record and I'm not as, by the time I'm hearing this record, I'm thinking I'm like way ahead of everyone and there. And I'm like, fucking, I am a some gutter punk crust punk or something, but that's not like in, that's nothing, you know, that's because I'm from small town suburbia, whatever. And then by the time New Wave comes out, I'm one of the, they sold out people, you know? So it's like, I know my, but I also like clamored for it, listened to it the day it came out, have my stuff I love on it. I will take that journey over the next couple of weeks and months. But
I mean, I look forward to hearing the podcast and hearing how you talk about like that era and how other people talk about that era, because, you know, it's an important era. I played a show with them at the Key Club in LA while they were recording New Wave. This is in 2006. And I was like playing some shows with Chuck Reagan, and Chuck was playing this like benefit show at the Key Club. And it was like the Bronx, Riverboat Gamblers, Flogging Molly, like Against Me, and like punk karaoke, and like me and Chuck Reagan, you know what I mean? Like we're like the acts on this fucking, this thing. So I saw them play the New Wave songs. Like they literally like left the studio and came over and played the show at the Key Club and then like went back to the studio. And I was like, these songs are so good. When they played like a couple of the songs that were on it, I was just like, this record is going to be great. So I was ready for the record to be great. And I also knew that they had already signed, you know, like to a major label, because I played with them like while they were in the studio making the record. When that record came out, I literally, like every time somebody was like, they're fucking sold out now, I just look over at them and I'd be like, shut the fuck up. You know, like, because that was like, I actually think that when New Wave came out, that was the moment when I like had lost all of my cynicism about Against Me. I realized that no matter what, people were never going to be happy. After watching what happened to them when they signed to Fat, when I watched the like the We're Never Going Home documentary or whatever, like, and they were like, had all these like executives and like different people taking them out, A&R like people taking them out, and they're like, blah, they're like, we're never selling out. And I remember, because I played with them in Prague when that was like a new release on the merch table, and they gave me a copy of it. I watched it like with my friends in Prague in the Czech Republic. And my friends were like, see, I knew that they would never sell out. And I just looked over at my friends and I was like, they should. I was like, I was just like, what allegiance do they fucking have? It's like if they stayed in the punk scene and never took that like multi-million-dollar contract, you know what I mean? That like would set up all of them for life, which it did. They're only cutting their nose off to spite their face because the scene already hates them.
I mean, the culmination of the Dan Ozzie book is basically Against Me like doing that. And then that's the idea of people even being criticized for trying to make some money off the music they make is borderline gone after that.
Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like if the punk scene were more like welcoming towards ensuring that like the artists that they care about could make a living, you know what I mean? Like, cause it's like in the punk scene, you are expected to like dedicate your entire life to this thing, to pleasing people, but yet like also be completely penniless, you know? And these two things like can't exist in the same space. They just can't, you know? And so like, if you want great art, like unfortunately, because we live in this like capitalist system that we live in, and it is unfortunate, believe you me, you have to sort of like at least passively participate in it, you know? And like when people act like you're a dick just for like having folks at your shows, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, it really tells so much, you know, like about, you know, like the mentality of this like group of people, you know, like when people are like angry at you for trying to sell a t-shirt, because back then it's like, we would try and sell t-shirts for $10 and people would be like, no, like we had to sell all of our CDs and all of our t-shirts for $5, you know, and we were getting paid nothing. It's like, how did we even, I mean, we ended up on those tours, like there was a time in the early 2000s where we were flying signs to like get to the next place.
Yeah.
And like, and that was because we just weren't getting paid anything hardly at all. Like, and we have a van, you know, like full of people. And like in the 90s, when I started booking shows, like, and going on tours, people fed you, people put you up, and they like paid you, You know what I mean? Like, it was always the touring band always got all the money, you know, like, and they like, you know, bent over backwards to make sure that you felt comfortable and accommodated. And like, and that evaporated in the 2000s. In the DIY scene, people like just were, they became so, they acted so entitled. The scene was full of people who were suburban kids who had money, you know what I mean? Like, and didn't need to work and expected to not have to pay anything, you know, like for the products that they, you know what I mean? Like that they wanted. And at the expense of the people who are like pouring all of their heart and soul into these things and like getting in vans with like no AC in the dead of summer. And then like, we're eating, you know, like hot dog bun sandwiches, you know, like with like chips and ketchup and mayo, because we could steal the hot dog buns out of the thing at the gas station.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's like,
and then
you
it's,
know, and all the condiments.
There's a whole, and then there's a whole like trappings around it of trying to do better than that is betrayal of the people in that scene. And yeah, that's pretty, that'll get you. I want to, where can people find you, Austin?
AustinLucas.com, online, like on Twitter, I'm Austin Lucas IND. I don't hardly ever post on Twitter. I don't know why I started with that one. Don't go to my Twitter unless you really love Twitter.
Unless you're Laura Jane Grace, and you want to have an exchange about making a covers record, and then you eventually make.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Twitter sometimes can be funny to like to poke fun at your friends and together with your friends at other things. But yeah, no, I'm on Instagram and it's Austin Lucas Music, and Facebook is Austin Lucas Music, and also TikTok, but I don't do a lot on TikTok. And I tour usually about 6 months out of the year, so you know, I'm coming to your town or someplace close to it probably in the not so distant future. So I don't know, holler at me on social media and find out, and let's party.
Hell yes. Well, thank you, Austin. The record is Reinventing Against Me. Check it out and watch for Austin. Thanks to Austin for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. You can support this show by going to patreon.com/afterthedeluge. Subscribe there for $5 and you'll get episodes early, ad-free, and at the end of the season, you'll get a zine all about Against Me and this season of the show. That's patreon.com/afterthedeluge. Thanks for listening. No one is lonely in a dream. She said